I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Krista Tippett is the award-winning host of On Being, which airs weekly here on WYPR and more than 300 other public radio stations. Originally called Speaking of Faith, On Being presents thoughtful guests exploring the challenging question of what it means to be human. Krista Tippett, in Baltimore for a WYPR event last night, joins me this hour in Studio A to talk about public radio as a social enterprise, to wit, her Civil Conversations Project, an effort to get people with different views about some of the hottest topics of our times to engage in thoughtful and respectful debate. Krista Tippett, On Being and Being Civilized, on Midday, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon once again, and welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for making Midday part of your day. In the second hour of our show today, Midday on Health, high-protein diets, they've been popular for a good while. But what's the score? Are they good for you? Are they bad for you? An 18-year study of human eating habits and health suggests that the answer to that question lies in how old you are when you're consuming lots of protein, especially animal protein. Nutritionist Angela Ginn Meadow and digestive health expert Dr. Gerard Mullen from Johns Hopkins will be with us in the second hour of our show today. We're a country with a lot of problems, a disturbing amount of violence, depravity, cynicism, poverty, uncertainty. We look around and see lots of people breaking bad, medicating themselves with everything from beer to marijuana to heroin. There's an unease in the country, something that's hard to describe, but something you can sense, the unhealthiness of our culture. Too many Americans without a grand vision of the future, maybe. Too many worries about the country and the planet. You add that to the personal problems people experience in the course of living their lives, and no wonder they want painkillers. We live in a noisy culture, too, a high-anxiety culture with lots of rancor and political divisions and what seems like systemic dysfunction and a loss of faith and trust in our institutions. Although it's been itching up in recent months, the percentage of Americans who approve of the job Congress is doing is still exceedingly low, 15%. That's slightly better than last year's 12%, but it extends a nearly steady string of low approval ratings since the beginning of the decade. Political discourse seems to be mostly hyperbole and angry rhetoric and hyperpartisan bickering. That means that meaningful conversation and debate about some of the most important issues of our time often gets drowned out by the noise, or it doesn't happen at all, and people retreat to the comfort of their prejudices. My guest in this hour of Midday is Krista Tippett, the host of the Peabody Award-winning radio show On Being. The show features interviews with some of the most compelling leaders on the world stage. Krista Tippett's latest endeavor is called the Civil Conversations Project. The project is a series of podcasts, live events, and online resources that are meant to inspire change through dialogue. In this endeavor, Krista Tippett's attempting to encourage people to step out of the noise, out of the echo chamber, and into thoughtful conversation. WYPR hosted Krista Tippett last night at the Maryland Institute College of Arts Brown Center. During her talk there, she took questions from the audience, but there were so many questions at the event, she couldn't get to them all. That's why we invited her on the show today. So we welcome Krista Tippett to WYPR and the Midday Show. Nice to have you with us, Krista.
It's good to be here, and I'm glad to continue that. It was a great conversation.
Yeah, what was
it started last night.
What was it like last night? I couldn't get there, but I heard good things.
Yeah, it was a great audience. You're in radio. Although you interact with your audience every day, right?
Yeah.
And I am, and my situation is different. So I'm in the studio, and I don't actually get out to a station, to a community like this all that often. So it's really exciting. It's very energizing for me just to be with people and experience how they're interacting with the content.
Because they're listening to On Being.
Yeah.
And then you finally
and they're even
to...
listening at 7 a.m. Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when I catch it.
Yeah.
When I'm going fishing.
That's when I catch it.
But I want to talk to you about this, your project, Civil Conversations. What got you to this?
So I think as people, as human beings and citizens ourselves, as much as anything else, my producers and I started feeling anxious and alienated, just like a lot of people we know, back at latest by the 2010 election season. Mm-hmm. And we started putting some shows on the air, which we only eventually started calling the Civil Conversations Project. We realized that we were digging into something, and it really took hold after the Gabrielle Giffords shootings, right? And what I was really aware of, especially at that moment, is suddenly in the wake of that terrible event, there were all these beautiful speeches and these pleas by the president and others for social healing and civil dialogue and moral imagination. And I know that those pleas were heartfelt on the part of politicians and that so many of us resonated with them. But nothing really happened, you know. Within a few weeks, we were back to business as usual. And my sense about that is that we couldn't rise to that occasion because we didn't really have visible models. And we don't really remember or see what civil discourse and social healing and moral imagination look like in the public and political square. So the Civil Conversations Project started with us, you know, having the medium we have, which is a radio show, to kind of flesh out that question. And then it's gone from there, and we've done some public events and just have continued to unfold it.
Well, that's great, and I admire the ambition and the effort that you put into this. We're going to listen to some excerpts of some of the podcasts that you produced on some pretty contentious issues. One, gay marriage, another one, abortion,
yeah,
which is a subject a lot of radio show hosts, such as myself, won't even tackle anymore.
Won't tackle, yeah.
And there's the reason for that is you feel like, you know, people are at loggerheads. There's 50% on one side, 50% on the other side, and you don't go anywhere with the conversation.
Yeah, but something I've been aware of for a long time is when was that election? I think it was the second Bush election. It was the God gap. Remember the polls, the exit polls in the election, and we came out of it saying there's this God gap, and
2004.
Yep. In that, even in that moment, which is, you know, one of the, you can date this polarization, I think, throughout this last decade. Even those same exit polls that showed a God gap, I think, and this is also where we started talking about red states and blue states and dividing ourselves up in new ways. Even on the issues of abortion and gay marriage, which are the two lightning rod issues, there was actually a majority on both of those issues between the two extreme polls that we always use to frame the discussion, right? Most people, like in both of those cases, like it's over 60% of Americans, a majority, who favor abortion with some limits. And, you know, and well, the gay marriage, that whole thing has just been so fluidly evolving, right? And on that, there is a majority of people, there is absolutely majority support for civil recognition of same-sex marriage. Now, also, and you know, you frame it that way, in both of these lightning rod issues, there's a lot of discussion that needs to take place about what some limits means, right? And mm-hmm. about, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, legalization of gay marriage, and then there's big soul searching that's going on about what that means about how religious institutions might sanction. But those are the discussions real people want to be having, not the fight that has been exhausting, that gets us nowhere, about whether you're pro-choice or pro-life, or whether you're, you know, well, pro gay marriage.
I'm
anti-gay
glad you're doing
marriage.
It. It seems like it's so. When you use the word fight, it seems like so quickly these things turn to fight.
Yeah.
You mentioned the shooting of Gabrielle Giffords mm-hmm. and others, the killing of a federal judge in Arizona, in Tucson,
yeah.
right? And then we get to Sandy Hook, in Newtown, Connecticut. A terrible, horrible tragedy. One of the worst mass killings that we've seen. And again, nothing happens. You know, again, people, there's this outpouring of grief and emotion and calls for, calls for reforms of guns. And as soon as you bring up the G word, guns,
it's another one of those
turns
dead
into a brawl.
Ends you walk towards, right? And it's the same brawl we've had many times over the last few decades.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are we supposed to do about that?
I
have on this show tried to engage members of the National Rifle Association post Sandy Hook. Mm-hmm. The conversation was civil. I guess we did our part here.
It's a process.
I don't know what a game
for us. It's a long, we're talking about cultural transformation, right? We walked into a bad place. We have bad habits. We have reflexes and instincts that are so ingrained now, and it's the way politics is done, and it's the way a lot of media is done.
How did that happen?
Well, I mean, I think we walked
into
really, it
no,
over.
No, really, no, seriously, how did that happen? Because I wonder, is it worse today than it was 20 years ago,
yeah,
30
and,
years ago?
Yeah, I mean,
ago?
That's a good question. But the times we are in require us to grow up, our ability to talk about big, hard issues. And it's not just gun control and abortion and gay marriage. In fact, you know, when people look back 50 years from now, they might not even notice those issues. We need to talk about the environment. We need to talk about income inequality. We need to talk about race. We need to talk about immigration, right? I mean, there are the discussions that we've so messed up that we just repeat the same dead-end discussion all the time, and then there are discussions we don't know how to have. And we have to mature our collective capacity to grapple with big, open questions. I mean, I'm really glad that you introduced this discussion in the way you did, which is, we're at this big moment, and it's stressful, and this is the home of Johns Hopkins, right? And science is telling this is us as much as anybody else, right? Like we know now, in very physiological ways, that when we as human creatures become fearful, when there's too much change, when there's any change, that this does not put us at our best. But we need to claim that knowledge as a piece of self-awareness and as a piece of control, because, you know, for so many reasons, we have to work very hard now to create the world we want our children to inherit.
What was the transition like? Well, you're still doing On Being, obviously, but I mean, I guess I'm talking about the flow in terms of how you conduct interviews, the aesthetic you bring to On Being toward this project.
Civil conversations.
Yeah, civil conversations. What has that been like for you?
Well, some of the civil conversations projects, the ones we did in that first year, were really just a big conversation like I normally do. You know, I talked to a philosopher, and I talked to a poet, and I talked to a civil rights veteran. And it was really just, but with this inquiry, if we think about this, the breakdown of civility and our inability to talk about big issues together in nuanced ways as a kind of a social crisis, then how do we think about social change getting out of this rut? But then we decided to really, you know, take it on where the rubber meets the road and say, okay, now we're going to do a public event. And that's obviously a different thing. That's then with two people instead of one. And also there's, and I've really come to love this format, you know, and it's you have a live audience. So there's an experience in the room, first of all, and mm-hmm. then later on, there's an experience of turning it into a radio show. You start a new kind of discussion in a couple of ways before it ever begins, and one is by not engaging people who are on the extreme poles, the same kinds of voices who are always invited to be part of it. Now, you absolutely bring difference into the room. But, you know, as I say, most of us, that all the discussions that we know get, it's, you know, this end of the spectrum and that end of the spectrum. And most of us are somewhere in the middle. I'm not sure I believe in the center, but most of us are left of center or right of center. But we still have a few questions left. And we still have some interest in grappling with these things with other people. And maybe even we're terrified and disgusted by the other side, but we'd like to understand where they're coming from so that we could at least talk to them, right?
I'm so with you on not going to the extremes, using your editorial judgment to say, okay, we're not going to the same voices that are heard on MSNBC, or we don't need Rush Limbaugh to engage this debate. Let's find a more moderate, thoughtful voice on either side of the issue.
So, yeah. I mean, when we did the gay marriage, and then the other thing that you do is, and this is I want to say, you said a minute ago, what can we do? What can we all do? We can absolutely reject the framing questions that have gotten us nowhere, right? We can say, if we talk about abortion, we're not going to frame it as pro-life versus pro-choice. We're just not going to do that. We're going to start it in a different place. And if we're going to talk about gay marriage, you know, we're not going to start it in the place of "are you for or against?" So when we did the show with Jonathan Rauch and David Blankenhorn is actually somebody who testified in the Prop 8 trial in California against gay marriage. Okay, so he was on one side of that issue. Jonathan Rauch is a gay man. What they both had in common was that for a long time, they had both been proponents of the importance of marriage as a social institution. And Jonathan Rauch, although he is a gay man and a gay rights advocate, although I think, you know, as soon as you start using those words, you start getting into those old places. He's probably the more politically conservative of the two of them. And David Blankenhorn, even though he for a long time was a gay marriage opponent, is probably the more politically liberal in many ways. And you know what? Most of us are like that, right? We don't fit into boxes. Only those talking heads on TV fit into boxes. And they make for good TV, but they don't make for good public life.
You set this up beautifully. Why don't we listen to an excerpt from it? So this is from one of the podcasts of Civil Conversations. This is from your conversation with David Blankenhorn and Jonathan Rauch in 2012.
Yeah.
And in this clip, we're going to hear Jonathan speak first.
Okay.
When I talk to young people in college campuses, they all think marriage is, you know, it's a thing two people do, and if they need a piece of paper from the state, that's just a convenience. And I tell them, no. Maybe you have to be gay to see this, what it's like to be excluded from a community and all the tools that go with this. But this is an institution. This is a commitment that two people make, not just with each other, but with their community. And that commitment is to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness, till health and health, till death do we part. That's a promise you as a couple are giving to care for each other and your children forever to your whole community, and the community has a stake in it. And that's what we gay people want. We want to be married in the eyes of community, in that web of family.
Well, but may I remind you that you may be able to do all those good things, but one thing you can't do is if you have children, you can't be a home where that child is being raised by the mother and father whose bodies created the child. That's the one thing you can't do.
Correct.
So I accept all the things you say about, especially you, you know, and people who are approaching the issue like you. Let us in. We can strengthen this institution. We have a higher level of idealism than a lot of you straight people. I hear it all. I really do. But there's issue of filiation, of the protection of the child by uniting these three strands of the parent relationship, the biological, the legal, and the social. That cannot be done in a same-sex relationship. And so the reason I was against gay marriage for all those years that we were arguing about it was primarily that reason. And, you know, for me, that's been the nut of it.
Krista Tippett's interview with David Blankenhorn and Jonathan Rauch, a conversation from 2012, part of the Civil Conversations Project. More with Krista Tippett when we get back. I want to talk about that a little bit. And you can give us a ring, 410-662-8780, if you have a question for Krista Tippett, host of On Being, who's with us for this hour of midday. Our toll-free long-distance number, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodrigues here with the host of On Being, Krista Tippett, who's also hosting a series of conversations called the Civil Conversations Project. And we just heard an excerpt of one of those that are online. You can find a link to them on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. Again, that was Jonathan Rauch, who is a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution and author of Gay Marriage, Why It Is Good for Gays, Good for Straights, and Good for America, opposite David Blankenhorn, who is a... what is David Blankenhorn? Founder and president of the Institute for American Values. Mm-hmm. Is that it, Krista? Mm-hmm. Well, I like the sound of that. I want to listen to the rest of that. And I think what I appreciate about it is I got the sense as it was flowing along there, even in the less than 2 minutes that we listened to it, that no one's going to change anyone's mind.
No.
Or that's not the point.
That's not the point. Right. So I want to say a couple things. And one is, especially on something like gay marriage, right, that... we get to step back, and I think we should step back as a culture, wherever we are on this issue sometimes, and just say, wow, what a big deal it is that we are redefining marriage, that our generation is redefining marriage, right? And just take that in, right, instead of leaping for the debate, right? And yes, it's not – the other thing that makes this easier, actually, is we have to let go of the idea that the point of all of our debate or dialogue – is for somebody to win and somebody to lose, right? That is really destructive at this point when we're dealing with these issues that are intimate and civilizational
complex.
And the work of generations.
Right.
And so, and David Blankenhorn, actually, in another place in that, he talks about the accomplishment of achieving disagreement, right? And that is, I think, like the, you know, a really basic and hopefully achievable goal for all of us who care about this, is that we find ways to keep talking to each other and keep listening to each other as we are different and disagree, and as we are engaged in this work of generations. You know, where David Blankenhorn has come out on gay marriage as a longtime opponent is that his commitment to marriage, as the social value of marriage, is greater than that. He is now saying that he wants to work together with everybody to strengthen the institution of marriage, and that same-sex couples are now part of that picture.
Hmm.
And you know that's where we are as a society, right? That decision in some ways has come down. And that's a different posture for someone to take and say, okay, I'm going to do this because I care about it, the institution of marriage. I care about our public life. And by the way,
I care about children
and the friendship that he's developed with somebody like Jonathan Rauch also just changes the tenor of that kind of decision.
Right. The part that I've never understood about Fox News or Fox programming, the so-called conservative echo chamber, and whatever echo chamber exists, if there's a left one, I guess it's MSNBC. I tune into MSNBC to hear, you know, what my own prejudice is affirmed by other people, right?
I guess that's
what I do, because if I lean to the left, or there hardly seems to be a place for the moderate. Maybe that's CNN. I don't know. We're talking about television here. But anyway, I've never understood that, because I always thought debate was more entertaining. Some people would use the word argument.
Right. Then just hearing people tell you what you want to hear.
Yeah.
Reinforce your opinion.
Yeah. But I mean, understand that there's a comfort in having your prejudices affirmed by others, right? I understand there's a comfort in that. But you can hear that in a debate as well. You can root for your side in a debate. So I've never understood why there isn't more of this, actually.
I think, though, that may get back to this big picture here that everybody's just unnerved right now. You know, everybody's on edge. And as you said, there's a strange
uneasiness.
Comfort.
Yeah. A comfort.
Somebody saying, okay, your reality is there, and we honor it, and you're right.
Right.
Right? And so there's a big requirement for everybody who cares about, you know, social healing, civil discourse, to find ways to calm fear. Like, almost before those discussions can start.
I agree with you, Krista. But you need it every day? You need a steady dose of it? I mean, what's wrong with a little rancor once in a while? What's wrong with having your prejudices challenged, too?
I think that should all be part of the mix. And it's probably very normal and natural to have places you go where somebody tells, you know, reinforces your position. But right now, we have that. And as you say, we almost exclusively have that. We don't have many places where there's actual debate happening. And we have precious few places where there's just calming, listening, all about ambiguity and nuance and how complicated this is.
Yeah.
Very little space for just laying that out there.
Let's listen to another excerpt from another podcast, another conversation, part of Krista Tippett's project, the Civil Conversations Project. So you can set this one up for us. This is the one on abortion, and we're going to listen to a good bit of it, because I think it's important that it gives us a sense of the larger conversation you had. This is the Christian ethicist David Gushee and longtime reproductive rights activist Frances Kissling.
Right. So Frances Kissling was ahead of Catholics for Choice forever. She was known by her opponents as the abortion queen. She's absolutely identified with the pro-choice movement. When she retired from Catholics for Choice about 5 years ago, she set as her personal goal to explore what it would mean to be in relationship with her political opposites. She was so discouraged, like a lot of people who are in that sphere on both sides, by the terrible place it's gotten to, the dead end, and the demonization on both sides of the other side. David Gushee is somebody who is a Christian ethicist and is on the pro-life end of the spectrum, but you know, really both of them are in this sphere that I mentioned a while ago, but that neither one of them is, you know, again, as most of us are not, it's always right or it's always wrong. They have some questions, they have some searching. So we brought them together to see, can we have a discussion abortion, which is not framed in terms of pro-life versus pro-choice, but a different animating question. What is at stake for us as human beings in this issue of abortion?
The first voice you'll hear is that of Frances Kissling.
I think those of us who are pro-choice are often crass about the fetus. And I think those who are pro-life, and we're using those terms right now, are very crass about women. Very crass.
Sometimes.
Well, sometimes the same on the right. both sides. But right. let's, you know, like, right. I don't want to push you to be more pro-life than you need to be, David.
Right. Some, just you know, being honest. Just being
right.
honest.
Okay.
So,
yeah. mm-hmm.
And I'm also aware that we're in a safe space here. We've created a safe space right here just for an hour and a half. It's an unusually safe space when it comes to this issue, maybe. And there is no
safe space.
Okay. And the real world dilemma that runs through both of your writing and all the writing and discussing on this is the fear on each side of what happens if you give a bit. So both of you are going to probably hear more from people inside on your own side of the discussion than from others. You know, Frances, there was something you have actually been writing about. Pro-choice activist calling for restrictions on late-term abortions. You've been raising this as an issue. And one reaction to something you wrote about that was, this is like offering the crocodile your arm so he won't right. eat the rest of you.
Right.
And that fear is real, and it's based on real experiences.
Right. Well, I think that you know, when you speak outside of the box and outside of the terminology that is known in your field, you are often misunderstood. I mean, people don't read what you write. They read what they think you're saying, and they read from their, you know, defensiveness. So, but I think, that, you know, if we're going to go beyond legality, then we have to answer the central question of ethics and morality. I'm not interested in compromise for the purpose of compromise. I'm interested in what's the right thing to do. And I no longer think, and I don't know yet exactly how to deal with this, I no longer think the right thing to do is that the only answer in the abortion question is, if a woman wants an abortion, whatever period of time it is, and for whatever reason it is, that's fine. And I would hope that David thinks there is more to this question of what is the right thing to do than that from the moment of conception, the conceptus has an absolute right to be carried to term and brought into the world. So I may actually have a little more, I don't know, I'm feeling righteous because I think I have a little more room than you do, but I'd love to hear you tell me that you got some room too.
Well, first of all, I think that what you're saying from your side is just a tremendous step forward. And I think that on my side, I would just say that this is an unsolvable problem apart from broad cultural attention to the well-being of women, to the fragility of our relationships, to the weakness of our social safety net, the problem of poverty, all kinds of factors that lead people to make the desperate choice of having an abortion. And to the extent that the pro-life side hasn't attended to that, it has not contributed to the conversation we've needed to have.
So I hear Gushy there make something of a concession, but really not budge very much from his position as described by Kissling.
Well, he says at one point that if pro-life activists don't pay attention to the things he just named, which includes the fragility of our relationships, the weakness of our social safety network, they might get what they want in terms of the law and not like the world they see on the other side of that win. Hmm. So you know, but when have we heard a pro-life and a pro-choice person agree that the pro-choice side can be crass about the fetus? I mean, that's honest language, and that the pro-life side can be crass about the woman. Mm-hmm. It's so refreshing. But you're right. Having a different discussion doesn't make it easier. I mean, it makes the whole thing, this was a very complicated, uncomfortable discussion in many ways.
How did you feel?
We ended up talking about the civic consequences of sexuality. That's not something we all like to talk about.
No.
Right? Whether the sexual revolution has been good for us.
That's where it went?
Yeah.
The conversation.
Yeah.
How did you feel at the end of this hour and a half?
Well, it was, I have to say, it was really thrilling because something new had happened. And it was more how much possibility it opened up than, you know, now again, we opened up a whole bunch of cans of worms, but they were new cans of worms. And they were honest and real.
No, you kind of asked for it. You set out to open these cans, right?
Yeah.
But again, this is a conversation that doesn't take place very much anymore in this country.
Everybody in the room, it was exhilarating for everybody in the room, and it was a very mixed room of people. There were people on both sides of the issue.
Again, that's one of the podcasts from Krista Tippett's project, the Civil Conversations Project, part of On Being. 410-662-8780. Krista Tippett, the host of On Being, our guest for the remainder of this hour. If you'd like to call in, perhaps you were at the Brown Center last night at MICA and heard Krista Tippett's remarks. If you have a follow-up question, a question you didn't get to last night, please give us a ring. 410-662-8780. Our midday email address is midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. We have the pleasure of the company of Krista Tippett in this hour of the show, and you're welcome to call 410-662-8780 if you've been listening to On Being, or if you've caught any of Krista's podcasts of the Civil Conversations Project, which is part of the social enterprise of On Being.
Yeah.
Right. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. I'm going to read an email here, and then we'll take a phone call for Krista. This one from Linda in Stewartstown, Pennsylvania. She says, as an atheist, I have nonetheless always been interested in religion. So when I woke up a few months back, way earlier than normal on a Sunday morning, and was able to listen to the head rabbi of England.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I was so fascinated, I stayed awake until it was over. Also, having left school early, I didn't think I could be interested in philosophy. But Krista Tippett changed my mind. Thank you very much, Linda and Stewart.
Oh, I love that. Thank you, Linda.
What was that conversation with the rabbi?
Oh, he's just one of the wise people in the world, Jonathan Sacks. He's just retired as chief rabbi of Great Britain.
It's a great thing about the job, isn't it?
Oh,
you get to speak to
is.
Some of the wise people of the world.
He actually wrote a book called The Dignity of Difference, which was about religious orientation towards difference. Really interesting.
Let's take a call for Krista Tippett. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Toll free is 866-661-9309. This is Naomi in Parkville. Naomi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
yes.
What did you want to say to Krista?
Well, I had two comments, both of them just effusively praising of both you and Krista. I have three young children, and I just have really fond memories when my second child, shortly after my second child was born, of just looking forward to Tuesday night. That was when Krista Tippett was on in West Virginia, which is where we were living at the time. And I would just be exhausted after a long day with a toddler and a baby, and I would just get into bed and turn on Krista Tippett and nurse my little baby and just kind of put the world back together. And so just a lot of thanks to Krista for the guests that she's brought on and the wonderful work she's done. And Dan Rodericks, for you, I now have three little kids kind of running underfoot, and you kind of bring a voice of reason and interest and something apart from Cheerios on the ground every day.
Excellent.
In the middle of the day. So thank you to you.
I'm glad
as well.
To hear that. Well, we both appreciate that call.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you,
it's
Naomi.
Great to hear.
Thank you very much. Krista, I recently had as a guest on the show the Reverend Raphael Warnock, who is the senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, of course, the historic church in Atlanta, Georgia. What an interesting conversation this was about. Well, his book is called The Divided Mind of the Black Church, and divided meaning he's wondering what the mission of the church is. Is it to save souls, or is it to put Christian values to work through social ministry? Mm-hmm. And then I brought up Pope Francis, and he got all excited about Pope Francis because he says this is my pope. You know, even though he's with the Ebenezer Baptist Church, he sees him as my pope, so to speak, because he's speaking the same language, so to speak, of social outreach, of getting, of clergy and others getting out and doing the work of what they see as Christian, putting Christian values to work through social ministry.
Yeah, and I said last night here that that I grew up Southern Baptist, very convinced, instructed that the Pope was the Antichrist. And I think one of the most fascinating things about Pope Francis is how he is being embraced by the Protestant world.
Yeah. He's kind of a Christian rock star, isn't
he? Everything from young evangelicals to, you know, your important black pastor in Atlanta.
Yeah.
That is fascinating.
So
that's
what's happening
new
there?
In human history.
Well, what's happening? What do you think that is?
Is it the
Nightingale song? You know, when you hear it, you know it's your song. Is that it? Is this what people have been waiting to hear?
You know, I don't know that anybody's asked me that question, so I'm just answering kind of off the top of my head. You know, there may be something to it that we're living in this age. You know, one of the stress inducing pieces of this moment is how basically authority and leadership, as we've known it, doesn't work anymore. There are very few voices who are privileged to really speak to the whole culture. And then you have this one religious authority, you know, the Vatican, the original global enterprise, you know.
It's true.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you have this unexpectedly humble, authoritative voice emanating from that. And actually, you know, maybe speaking into this space that you and I have been describing here, where not many leaders have been speaking. Speaking into the space of having questions as well as answers.
I think you did that beautifully off the top of your head. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Here's another call for Krista Tippett. Michael in Baltimore. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to ask Krista if she'd considered other venues other than her radio program to expand this message. You know, maybe I don't watch lower number cable channels or whatever, but perhaps there's some other venue that would spread the word quicker or more universally.
Well, Chris is on 330, is it right?
Yeah,
public radio stations. That's pretty good.
I'll tell you, we have just created an independent production company this last year. So we're asking this question about what we do, but I have to say I love radio. And I couldn't have created this kind of show, a big long form conversation, anywhere but public radio. Now, podcasting is obviously as much a part of our identity now as the radio, and that is our biggest area of growth. And we are thinking about creating different forms of content for the podcast. We just actually created an app. There's an OnBeing app in the iTunes store.
Wow.
So in some ways, we are incrementally branching out. You know, the internet makes so much possible. It's just the question we're asking is, it's a capacity question. How much can we do? And I do, you know, again, I want to say, I think our base in radio won't change because it's just a very special place.
It's also hard to imagine what you're doing fitting into the television landscape because television, what it's become, I don't want to get too down on TV here, but it's hard to imagine a show like that, people listening for an hour and a half to a conversation like that that isn't contentious, angry conversation. It isn't, edgy, filled with edgy rhetoric or bringing those extremes into play, which, of course, TV producers love. Right?
Well, and you've used the word entertainment. I mean, TV needs to be entertaining in a way, visually entertaining, to keep audience. And having to focus on that to how we create our content would fundamentally change things. I'm not saying I would never do it or wouldn't be open to it, but it's not the first thing I'd do.
This is Andrew writing to us by email, midday@wipr.org. More often than not, I find myself yelling at the radio rather than saying amen. But your introduction of Krista Tippett put into words all that I feel about the sad state of public and even private discourse today. So thanks for that. We are conditioned to frame our differences within the extreme, most hyperbolic terms. Manufactured outrage, always exposing duplicity, is exhausting. There's enough to be outraged about. We don't need Mark Levin fomenting anger about Michelle Obama and her family visiting China. Yeah, yeah, we do get a lot of that, don't we? Yeah.
Yeah,
I guess
yeah.
That's why I'm doing radio too. Why I'm happy to be here.
You know, speaking again to what we're learning about how we go to our worst self rather than our best self, that fear and anxiety brings that out in us. And then you have that complicated by media personalities and products, which actually very intentionally trip those fear and anxiety places in us.
Yeah.
And that's bad.
You know, we've had a couple of conversations on this show. One was about the DREAM Act in Maryland. It was up for a vote a couple of years ago, whether to provide state-level tuition rates for the children of undocumented immigrants who are themselves undocumented. Some people use the word illegal. I just use the word undocumented. And it was a contentious issue that voters got to vote on here. So we had a debate on the air, and it was hard to find the kind of voice on that was opposed to the DREAM Act that you're describing. It's not over there on the extreme, but sort of toward the middle, thoughtful, conceding some problems with his view, maybe, but sticking to his view, right? It was difficult. So then, we got one of those very extreme voices here on the air, and our listeners did not go for that.
Yeah.
And I felt like maybe we had failed at finding the right person, but I don't know who that would be. It seemed like the only spokesman on that issue that particular year were extreme.
So, so one of the ways we we structure these and envision them is, so I usually start when we're going to do a dialogue with one person, right? So I knew Frances Kissling, and I knew about this person who'd been very associated with a certain side of it and who'd set out to be in a relationship. And so I went to her and said, who would you like to be in conversation with? And I did the same thing with, I think I started with Jonathan Rauch. Whenever we do two people like this, and often the person they know, you know, David Gushy or David Blankenhorn, other people, maybe you just look for Davids.
Right.
are people who probably have not been on the talk shows, right? But they may have come across them in some other setting and said, you know, that person is on a different side from the issue, but that's someone I could talk to. That's somebody who wants to listen. And, you know, so we have to, it's hard because the obvious characters are not the right characters, but you really have to dig and be creative to find those other voices.
You do. And I would say it's hard to find the moderate voice frequently, the thoughtful moderate voice with informed opinion. That's on my experience here, although we're still on the quest. Another email, a question for Krista Tippett. I have been struck by how you seem to keep the conversation practical. Is that something you and your producers consciously think about? And if so, how do you keep these conversations from getting too heady or highbrow and getting lost in generalities?
Well, that is something I'm committed to. I mean, I do, you know, our show is pitched intellectually high. I do like big ideas, but I'm interested in how big ideas meet complex reality. And I would just say that that's something I have in mind constantly as I am moderating one of those discussions. And it does go to those big thought-provoking places. But then it's kind of the dance, right? It's letting it go there and then always pulling it back. It's that intersection of things.
You know, I'm glad you said you wanted to stay in radio, especially with the Civil Conversations Project, because I could see you taking that somewhere. Do you have a vision maybe with this independent production that you could pitch that to a public radio audience?
It's on the radio too.
So it's on the radio.
It's embedded in our show, right?
It's embedded in On Being.
Yeah. So a certain number of our shows have been these Civil Conversations shows. So they're events, and then we turn them into a radio show and a podcast.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Right now, that's how it works.
But I mean, I guess I was wondering if you saw yourself as moderating more conversations like that on a more regular basis. Is it possible for growth with that?
Yeah, I think so. And also, I think moderating them in communities, you know, taking this on the road. But then what's great is because we have a radio show, whenever I do one of these public events, we can then usually turn that into a radio show. So you get both.
What's the next one? Do you know what your next topic is?
We are thinking hard about... The issue of race, and you know, this constant refrain we hear in this culture, even more since President Obama was elected, that we don't know how to talk about race, you know, and then something happens like the shooting of Trayvon Martin, which is such an imperfect, horrible, you know, emotional moment for us to rediscover that we don't know how to talk about this. So we're talking about what it would mean if we, over the next year, you know, have this sustained attention. And I think one of the challenges with race or anything is the language. Like, immediately when you say it's a discussion about race, people start to get into their corners, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. they think they've had this discussion before. So it's what's the language, and what are the framing questions, and how do we get at this in a way that opens it up? That's what we're thinking about now.
The people of different races have different reactions to that. To that idea.
Yes.
I heard somebody once say that white people like to pat themselves on the back when they have the idea about having a conversation about race. This was coming from a black gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he wasn't too excited about the idea, but he noticed that white people seem to be more often than black people are. That was a general comment.
And I think that's absolutely out there. So the question is, how can you frame this in a way that everybody wants to be involved?
Let's take another call for Krista Tippett. Fahim. Is this Fahim Yunus? Fahim?
Yes, thank you very much for having
Hello,
me,
Hello, Fahim, president of the Muslim Community Association.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm glad you called. You're on with Krista Tippett.
Thank you very much. Fascinating conversation. Krista, I had a two-part question for you. As a Muslim American in the post-9/11 America, I've heard a lot of corrosive conversations, extreme conversations about Islam on the media. I think Dan Roddick has played a beautiful role of having some civil dialogue on his show. My two-part question for you is, in the list of guns, abortion, race, gay marriage, where in that rank order do you see Islam in America a dozen years out from 9/11? Is it really top on the list, or have we come to terms with it? And second, on your show, have you brought moderate voices to develop some good consensus, have a civil dialogue about this issue that affects millions of Muslim Americans? Thank you.
Yes. Thanks for the question. I haven't crafted Islam as a civil conversations topic. The way it's been, I would just say instead, it's been so important in these years. My show was created in the years after 9/11 as well. It's been just important routinely to bring in Muslim voices to introduce my listeners to Muslims who, you know, and I don't even want to say who are moderates, but just to expand people's imaginations about who Muslim Americans are, right? So I immediately think of a conversation I had with a young man named Rami Nashashibi, who is an incredible social activist in inner city Chicago. His Muslim identity is absolutely essential to who he is. He works with social justice. He works with the arts. He works with the young. But, you know, we didn't focus on him as a Muslim, but on the life he's leading. And in fact, you know, though that does become, Rami Nashashibi in particular, becomes an imagination-opening experience for people of who Muslim Americans are and what that can mean. So that's really the way we've taken that on. I would also say that if we spend some time talking about race, you know, I'm very intrigued by the fact that 30% of the American Muslim population is African American, and I think that's a story that is not told, mm-hmm. and that's something we try to talk about too. So I think the Islam discussion is just woven into how we talk about the entire American experience and the entirety of life and religion.
So we'll be listening for more civil conversations, the part of the Civil Conversations Project of On Being, embedded in your show at 7 a.m. on Sundays, right? 7 a.m. on Sundays on WYPR and available through podcasts. And folks, if you haven't been listening to this, please check it out. On Being with Krista Tippett. It's great to have you on the show. It's nice to finally meet you, Krista.
Great to be with you, Dan, and your listeners.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Please enjoy the rest of your day here in Baltimore. We got a little bit of snow for you. You're used to a lot more than this,
aren't
you?
It's wimpy coming from Minnesota. Don't take it seriously.
Thank you very much, Krista. Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into our first hour of midday today. We're going to take a break for a lunch brought to us by Bagby Pizza Company. And then we'll have the news from NPR on the second hour of our show, a midday on Health Hour.